therefore creating this magnetic field. Now, that might be similar to, you know, I mean, that might not be a metal where, you know, it's actually magnetic. I think it might just be creating the magnetic field. Maybe you can comment on that. Just like copper, you know, you could put a magnet next to copper and nothing happens, but make copper a wire and put a current through it and you got an electric magnet. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, Paul. Well, I think that kind of brings up the very weird topic of magnetohydrodynamics, which is when conducting material is moved at a very rapid rate, and the electrons that are delocalized in that metal, then you take a charge and you accelerate it across something, and you produce a induced magnetic field. So I think that's more magnetohydrodynamics than it is just that the core of metallic hydrogen becomes magnetized. And at this point, up until, say, about a couple of months ago, metallic hydrogen was an unproven theory. They think that they might have produced a very small sample in the lab using those diamond presses. But to say that the core is full of it, that would be interesting to find out. I'm not sure how you would find that out, though, but that would be curious. But I think that's something a little bit different than simple ferromagnetism.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that they almost had it done in a lab, or maybe they did. Very good. Well, they're looking at it at Jupiter intently for a couple of years now with the Juno spacecraft. You know, it's in a polar orbit, so I know they're getting a lot of information from that. But I don't believe it's conclusive yet. It's still a theory. Back to you, Roy.
Okay. It's going to be quite interesting to find out. I'm sure there's a lot of clever guys out there, and they'll figure out some experiments to infer whether the core is metallic hydrogen. Yeah, the unfortunately, in laboratories, the best that they could do, I don't even think they're micrograms. They're probably picograms of metallic hydrogen. And they've just been able to record lab values consistent with that material. It's not like anyone has come up with a vial full of the stuff, because the pressures are so humongous that there's nothing other than maybe a diamond pressurized crucibles or whatever, pistons or something like that, in order to replicate the enormous pressures required to turn liquid hydrogen into its metallic form.
Oh, okay, very good. Good to know. Just wanted to verify that. Very good. Back to you, Roy. We'll continue on. This is WS2M.
Okay, very good, Paul. Wesley, you wanted to ask something or say something?
Yeah, a few comments, if you don't mind.
Comment away, Wesley. It's your dime.
There is some kind of misunderstanding. People think about ferrites, and then we have the ferrite magnets. In both of them, we have a powder that is present, compact into dye. If pressing takes place within external magnetic fields, the magnets particles will be aligned, and the magnet produced will be anisotropic. If the powder is pressed without external applied field, the magnet will be isotropic and have weaker magnetic properties, like in drums. But the thing is that both of them are made of small iron particles. And one way could ask, why do you use a ferrite for it? Well, one of the explanations is that we have a strontium carbonate and barium and iron oxides. One of the most popular would be Fe2O3. And you have to somehow put them together. It's a very inexpensive. And now again, we have a green state of that newly formed magnet, and then we put it to a sintering at high temperatures, and we make the magnet. In both, the ferrite that is used for transformers and ferrite that is used for magnets, the process is exactly the same as the job. And we have a samarium cobalt, which is also the ferrite. So my question to you would be, what is the difference between those two? The ferrite used for the transformers and the ferrite magnet. Enter here.
Okay, Wesley. We kind of covered this one time. This is ferrimagnetism as opposed to ferromagnetism. Ferrimagnetism usually entails different iron oxidation states and other elements like boron. There are two different types of ferrite material based upon the mixtures used. Hard ferrite material, known generally by most people as ceramic magnets, are your basic magnets. Not terribly strong, but they hold on to a magnetic field. Once you release them from the external magnetic field, they stay in that magnetic orientation, and their magnetic dipole moments are maintained when an external magnetic field is removed. Soft ferrite, which you see in transformers, which you see in ferrite chokes, are soft ferrites. They have very little magnetic memory. When you remove the external magnetic field, they randomize rather easily, which is what you would want to do for a transformer core, because if it had a good, strong memory as far as its magnetic polarization, it would introduce more hysteresis loss than if it didn't. So soft ferrites are good for chokes and transformers. Hard ferrites are good for ceramic magnets.
I think you picked up the wrong corridor in the building. Well, not necessarily the most unfortunate one. The major question was, what is the difference between ferrite used for ferrite transformers and a ferrite used for magnets? Both of them are made from particles. And to exceed.
Okay, Wes, I mean, to me, I think I answered that, actually. I mean, if you want the quantum mechanical reason why the remnant, which is the quality of being able to hold on to a magnetic memory of an external field, is more in the mixtures of the material added to the iron oxide, that's kind of a graduate level course, if anything like that even exists. But ultimately what it comes down to is they've tried a lot of different mixtures, and they measure their magnetic quality. They measure their remnants. They measure other aspects of magnets. And soft ferrites are made from mixes that have a very low remnant, where the magnetic dipole moments are dissipated the moment the external field is quenched. And ceramic magnets, hard ferrites, use a slightly different mixture of these other minerals with iron oxide that hold on to the magnetic field produced by the external field. So I don't know, other than starting a chalk talk on quantum mechanics, how I could answer the question that you're asking, other than this way.
No, I'm not going to go that complicated. I'm not going to go to the summarize it in atomic level. The good point that you made is memory, but then the memory is proportional to the size of the particle, and we have a nanopowder that could be used for ferrite. The main point is rusting, isolation of the particles. So, let me challenge you. Do you think that ferrites used for magnets are rusted? Prior, that means there is a layer that is isolating it from another particle when the bonding is added to the compound lipid, right? Is that process used also for magnets, or that process is reserved only for ferrite material used for the transformers and to XGS?
Okay, not quite sure what the question is, but let me try and see if I hit it. Iron is an interesting thing. Iron metal is ferromagnetic. Some types of iron oxide are ferromagnetic. Some types of iron oxides are not ferromagnetic. It has to do with the combination with other items and its oxidative state, whether it's ferric or ferrous, which is a different thing. And you can make a combination of some ferric and some ferrous in ferrite that helps you attain what you want to do in soft ferrites. In hard ferrites, my guess would be you want to stay with stuff that's only magnetic and ferromagnetic, and you want to maximize the magnetic density in the material. So in ferrites, there are oxides that are introduced. That's part of the mix of all the ferrites that we buy, includes iron oxides. In aluminum, nickel, cobalt, and others, there's pretty much no oxygen. But in ceramic magnets, there is oxides, but the oxides that are ferromagnetic.
Yeah, well, we're coming to the point of permeability. Do you think term permeability applies to magnets?
I missed that word. Did you say temperature depends on magnets?
Do you think that permeability applies to magnets?
Yes, I think it applies to magnets. It's one of the qualities of a magnet.
In electromagnetism, permeability is the measure of the ability of a material to support the formation of magnetic field with itself. And it is degree of magnetization that a material obtains in response to applied magnetic field. Magnets, by its nature, have nothing to form. They are formed already. What would be the difference between permeability of ferrite used for the transformer to the permeability that is used by magnets?
Okay, I'm kind of losing the thread of what the question might be. Permeability is sort of like magnetic resistance. The more permeable an item is, the more magnetic flux lines can concentrate across the material. High mu material, and it becomes, you know, important in the transformer cores or such. I'm sure it has some kind of effect on magnets themselves, but it's another quality of a kind of conduction of a magnetic field.
I have a problem with the explanation. Permeability, we call it magnetic permeability, is a constant of proportionality that exists between magnetic induction and magnetic field intensity. Magnet has nothing to induce. It is permanent magnet. It has a memory of that what was stored there. The domains already directional and keep that memory in it. That's why I ask you, is permeability term as a term to be applied to both or only to the ferrites that I use for the transformers and to XGS?
Well, it's an important factor in the transformers because they're not ferromagnetic. As you pointed out, objects that are already ferromagnetic don't necessarily need to concentrate the fields of magnetic flux since they're the ones creating the fields of magnetic flux. But I'm sure there's a way of measuring ferromagnetic material's ability. And again, it's wonderful to talk about vector sums and all kinds of things, but ultimately I think it's easier for people to understand that without something that's permeable, magnetic fields kind of open up and widen out. We've all seen a bar magnet and iron filings, and those lines of flux go out and out. They all go back in because divergence of magnetic fields is zero. That's one of Maxwell's equations. But if you place something with a high permeability, those lines will concentrate locally rather than spread out and somewhat oppose each other. So I don't know how easier to kind of say this, or if that's the question that you wanted answered.
In my set of questions, I was trying to establish one single point. Ferrites used for transformers are rusted, and its particles are isolated from the rest of the particles. They cannot conduct the current. Magnets, in their majority, they are they don't have a high resistance to the current. There are some of them, but the major point is that if we have a constant which would be 1.2.57 times 10 to minus 6 of Henry per meter, which is the free space vacuum, and by that condition we look at magnetic induction and magnetic field intensity. Magnet has nothing to do with it because it's already formed. There is no induction. So the major difference it was, and the question was, is permeability to be applied as well to magnets if it's already applied to ferrite use for transformers and to XGF?
I don't know, Wes. It might be that my brain isn't working for this question or what have you. The reason why a transformer cores are insulated is because transformer cores are subject to induced eddy currents. And eddy currents are a way of energy being wasted in the transfer of energy from the input winding primary to the output secondary. So that's the reason why it's non-conducting, because you do not want induced eddy currents sapping the energy of a power transformer's efficiency. I'm not quite sure what any of this has to do with permeability, because permeability is not a function of resistance. It's, like I said, if you want to, you could think of it as a term for magnetic conductivity. So I don't quite understand where the path of this question started and where it ended. As I said before, it's a very simple concept of why transformers are laminated and why they're made of material that are insulated from itself is to limit the eddy current power loss.
Interesting. One of the parameters of ferrite is versus a silicon plates, base plates that were used in 20th century for the transformers, is that particles are isolated. Also, the size of the domains, the size of the physical particle. You are dealing with the plate, and the eddy current was able to circulate in the single plate, and you had a number of plates that were isolated plate from plate. Now you have a ferrite where the size of the particle is very small. So if it retains the memory and you make it from nanopowder, the amount of mass that retains the memory is easier to demagnetize and change the vector of dipole than it was in much bigger plates. But the thing is that I am asking you, and maybe Dick, should we use the term of permeability for magnets when everything is already formed and nothing is to be formed any longer into existence.
Okay, once again, I'm not kind of getting the point. Maybe something wrong with me. It's not that it's decreasing a size. It's decreasing the extent of eddy current. The cheapest earlier approach was simply to make material and laminate it so you don't get the eddy currents going across the laminations, but you still had it going across the sheet of material. By using sintering and insulating matrices, you can isolate the currents induced much better and lessen the eddy current. It's not changing the permeability. It's not that it's small size, because it's the mass of the soft ferrite that's doing the magic. So if you decrease that and make it smaller but with less mass, you decrease the efficiency of it. So most likely they're putting roughly about the same amount of the soft ferrite material. They are just isolating it electrically, resistance-wise.
Thank you very much for the explanation for Dick. That permeability as a term applied to permanent magnets when nothing is to be induced any longer. And to Exia.
I could make a very loose definition of permeability where I take a material under study, put it inside of a solenoid coil. I put a known number of amps to that coil, developing a certain number of ampere turns. That, in turn, will create a certain amount of magnetic field inside of the material, and a material of higher permeability will develop a stronger magnetic field for the same number of ampere turns. Okay, so in order for permeability to be evaluated, I am typically changing the amount of ampere turns and measuring the resultant magnetic field. In the case of a permanent magnet, I'm not going to get that linear relationship. I may change the number of ampere turns on a permanent magnet that's inside of my solenoid coil, and I might have very little change in magnetic field. So in that case, rating its permeability becomes questionable, indirect, and maybe inappropriate. Does any of that make any sense, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW?
I think it makes perfect sense to me. It's probably innate in the material, but how to directly measure it and how it has much to do with things is more philosophical than anything else. But Wesley, is that a good description to you?
Well, the thing is that for me, permeability is related to dynamics of the process. Magnets has nothing to do with dynamics. The magnetic flux is steady, is fixed, is unchangeable for the permanent magnet. Dr. Roy?
Ken, I disagree with you. If you take say, horseshoe magnet, and if you take two identical horseshoe magnets, and in one you place a permeable material between the two ends of the horseshoe magnet, and the other one you don't put anything, and you sprinkle iron filings over it, you will find a constriction of the magnetic flux lines in the material that has the high permeability material between the two poles that you wouldn't see in the one that doesn't. Now, that's a static magnetic situation. So I don't agree with you that permeability requires a dynamic magnetic field changes.
Before you made something to be static, you had to have a dynamic applied to make it static. So for me, permeability is related to magnetic to dynamics of the processes. That's why we have a ferrite used for the transformers, not to statics. Dick?
I think we've got a trade-off situation here. For every material that I want to study its magnetic properties, I can put it inside of a coil, change the magnitude and polarity of the current flowing through the coil, and I can draw a BH curve for that particular material. For material that has high retentivity, I'm going to get a great big empty gap in the middle of that BH curve. For material with low permeability, with low retentivity, I'm going to get a simple line. The slope of the line is related to permeability. The separation between the upgoing line and the downgoing line is the a degree of retentivity. Is a material a permanent magnet, or is it a permeable magnet? Is it a variable? There's a whole bunch of variations in between. I can create a whole array of materials that have a different BH curve. So to some degree, every material has permeability. Every material has retentivity. And by drawing that BH curve, I can find how much of each. Nothing is pure one without the other, in my opinion. ACQGS, K2IW.
I would agree with you, Dick. I think the best approach to permeability is to perceive it as the magnetic counterpart to something like conductance. There are insulators, but insulators are not perfect insulators. Everything has a degree of conductance. In the same way, everything has a degree of permeability. Sometimes it's important, sometimes it's completely unimportant. But I think that's the best approach to look at this. There are many, many mathematical, geometric, physics, all kinds of approaches, but that seems to be the easiest one for me.
VDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
I think what may be causing some of the confusion is the relationship between H and B. B equal mu H. The idea that H is the excitation, ampere turns per meter, and B is the flux density, which is Weber's per square meter. What relates them is mu, and it might be a confusion between those two particular components that may be causing problems.
You might be right, John. A lot of times people have gotten the two numbers confused and what they represent and in physics. So it might be a case with what's going on. I don't know if that would be what Wesley would consider. But I don't know. I think we've kind of done this to death, and I really would like to do my little puzzler, although I think Dick already has the answer to it this week. But if you have any other comments, now's the time.
Thank you very much, for your answers. Thank you.
I vote we go for the puzzle.
Okay, very good. It's unanimous. Okay. Life is complicated, and the job of science popularizers like Stephen Hawking in his time or Neil deGrasse Tyson these times tries to smooth away some of the complications. But science ultimately, unfortunately, is still a wee bit complicated, as Wesley has demonstrated tonight. Take the example, the concept of temperature, which has been brought up here before and no doubt will be brought up again. Temperature, how would you define what temperature is?
And a related question I've given to subjects is, what does a thermometer measure? And boy, you get a ridiculous number of answers. It measures how hot or cold. It measures how much heat is present. But what is hot or cold? What is temperature? And that's sort of what you're asking. And not many people have got a good physics at the molecular level understanding of what does that thermometer measure. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, exactly, Dick. And so I thought as a little micro puzzler, we would go into some of the nitty-gritty details about what temperature is, what does it mean to be hot or cold, what's actually happening on a molecular level.
And to Rio.
And to Rio.
VDH.
Okay, Rich first.
Okay, fine there. Remember that the fact older it gets, electrons on the nucleus slow down. And conversely, hot means they speed up. I'm thinking people believe Kelvin is so much. They stand still.
need more volume, Rich, and I disagree with that answer. I back you, Roy.
Yeah, Richie, if you would have noticed, we were having this conversation, me and Dick, where we basically said the exact opposite, that electrons don't stop. Electrons don't travel at orbital velocities. Electrons kind of jump within a cloud of probability that's defined at the lowest energy level as a kind of a surface of a sphere, if you will. But they don't stop. No, temperature is definitely not the velocity of an electron.
Okay, I stand corrected. I'll try and get something done about the audio, Dick.
Yeah, you got to shout into that mic right now. Wes, go ahead.
What is the explanation for Josh Moore would be degree of hotness and coldness? It is measured on defined scale. The more advanced would be temperature, is the measure of average kinetic energy of the particles of a substance. The higher the temperature on an object, the higher is its kinetic energy, and to exceed.
I think I agree with that, and that kinetic energy is because the whole Don molecule is translating. Is that where the kinetic energy is coming from, Roy?
Let me first hear John wanted to say something, and then I'll get into that interesting little aspect.
Yeah, I would agree with that as the average internal energy of the substance, but I would also think it might include rotational energy as well as kinetic energy. It gets a little dicey, however, if the density of the material goes down, such as the condition in outer space where you may only have a couple hundred atoms per square per cubic meter.
Okay, you know, John and Dick kind of hit it, and Wesley to a degree also. The thing, though, is, and I hate to fall back on semantics because that's, you know, troubling to use the English language to explain something, but that's what we got. Kinetic energy is not only translational. Kinetic energy, at least from my understanding, can be rotational and vibrational. They're all aspects of kinetic energy. Wouldn't you agree, Dick?
Yeah, but I don't understand exactly. Are you talking about average heat or thermal energy of the particles in the substance?
I think we're trying to describe what does a thermometer measure. In the case of a solid material where I bury a thermometer in it, the kinetic energy in that case is the individual molecules are suspended alongside of each other as if they're connected with springs, and they're vibrating back and forth. A higher temperature solid material has more vibration. In the case of gaseous and liquid materials, an awful high percentage of the kinetic energy is due to translation. They're really moving around and bouncing off of each other. But it's the kinetic energy in all cases, whether they're vibrating back and forth or translating and bouncing and spinning, it's the kinetic energy of the individual molecules. That's what a thermometer is measuring, I believe. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Okay, so basically, and I've heard you very adroitly describe the concept of gaseous particles, you know, going back to the ideal gas law, gaseous particles banging up against the boundary, and that kinetic energy imparting the temperature of the gas. Now, if you kind of take that atom of gas and you spin it like a top someplace, does that really reflect the same phenomena of the temperature of the translational kinetic energy?
Not very easy to grab an individual molecule and spin it. If I take a gaseous material in a container, and I put a Bunsen burner underneath it, and the average temperature inside that container of the gas goes up. The kinetic energy of that gas has increased. That's what the thermometer is measuring. And a certain percentage of that kinetic energy is rotational, and a certain percentage of it is translational. And I think the translational dominates because it's not very easy to spin a molecule. When it glances off another molecule and hits at a crazy angle, you're going to get some spin. But I think the majority of the kinetic energy is translational in the case of gaseous materials. In the case of solid materials, I think almost none of it is rotation, very little of it. Yeah, it can twist back and forth on its springs, but vibrating back and forth is more of it. And a hot gas going into a cold container is moving around so rapidly and it's banging against the walls, it will eventually increase the vibration of the walls. Therefore, it's increasing the temperature of the walls. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Okay, but we're kind of left with the interesting question of why does everyone say the ideal gas law? What is the nature of an ideal gas? What makes something an ideal gas and other things a non-ideal gas? And what are the complications of a non-ideal gas that screw up the ideal gas law?
I'm going to guess that an ideal gas is one that has a very predictable number of molecules per cubic meter based on temperature and gas. If you tell me the temperature and the pressure, and it's an ideal gas, I know exactly how many molecules are in there, and it's related to Avogadro's number. Is that one possible explanation, right?
Well, you could probably calculate the concentration of a non-ideal gas.
Tell me what makes a gas non-ideal. I presume most ideal gases, the spacing between the molecules is large compared to the volume of each molecule. In the case of ordinary air at room temperature and room pressure, the molecule of air is somewhere around a nanometer in diameter, but the mean free path is around 30 nanometers. In other words, a moving molecule of room temperature gas has to move about 30 nanometers before it strikes another molecule. So the space between them is large compared to their individual volumes. The majority of what's in between the individual molecules is empty space, and they're bouncing around and sometimes hitting each other. That's what I think an ideal gas is. Over to you, Roy.
Okay, so basically any gas at a particular low pressure would attain the same thing as a ideal gas.
I agree with that. Now, as I increase the pressure tremendously, where I'm starting to get into the various changes of state, where I'm about to turn into a liquid or a solid, now I'm pretty sure you're out of the realm of an ideal gas. The number of molecules per cubic meter can now become a very different number, I think. And the number of compounds, and whether or not it's in the liquid or gaseous or ionic state, starts changing for a non-ideal gas. Over to you, Roy. That's a guess.
It becomes.
Yes, Wesley, you wanted to say something?
Yes. I think to concentrate on only one aspect of it. We could say the temperature is the measure of average kinetic energy of the particles on the substance, but we could say the temperature is the measure of the average heat or thermal energy of the particles in the substance. And we're talking about thermal equilibrium, we could say that the temperature is the quantity in which the same for both system when they are in the thermal equilibrium. So let's say you have an empty box that has a perfect vacuum and there is a floating particle there, or the iron ball there. And this container is inside of the room that is at temperature of 1,000 degrees of Celsius. Let's say, what would be the temperature of that ball that is inside, freely floating? Let's say there is no, it's floating, it's no gravitation there. So, if you're talking about the stuff, you drifted to one side only, the perfect gas whatsoever. There is no gas, there is a vacuum, and to exchange.
Again, you've lost me down this path. Heat energy is not directly temperature, which you could easily tell by if you, say, have the heat energy, if you want to use BTU, if you want to use calories. If you take one calorie to 1 gram of water, you raise it 1 degree centigrade. If you take the same energy and put it in a completely different material, you get a different temperature increase. So that's, it's related to temperature, but it's not the same as temperature, heat energy.
I think you've just described two different materials that have different specific heat. Specific heat of a material is a parameter that helps an awful lot in what you're now describing. Is that true, Roy?
Indeed, Dick, and it's the concept of specific heat that kind of demonstrates the fact that, unfortunately, it's not as simple as just saying the kinetic energy of a substance defines its temperature, but how much of that kinetic energy is portrayed as a translational kinetic energy as opposed to a purely rotational or vibrational. And one of the things that describes a ideal gas is a gas that doesn't interact with other atomic bonds of gases, of the atoms, and also does not have an inherent rotation or vibrational phase in which some of the kinetic energy can be somewhat loaded into those kinetic energy types that don't directly translate into translational kinetic energy that is heat. Now, some of the vibrational and rotational energy can interact with others and become translation kinetic energy. But that's why some things require more energy to raise their temperature, because some of the energy is going to do non-temperature-related energy states.
I'm going to give an example of that. Water is known to have an extremely high specific heat. Air has a specific heat that's a hell of a lot lower. If I have a human being with no clothing on, so he's got no insulation, and I put him into a room with 50-degree Fahrenheit air, he's cold, but he can tolerate that for a long time. I put him into a pool of water at 50 degrees Fahrenheit, he can't tolerate that very long before the heat of his body gets drained, he goes into hypothermia, and it becomes life-threatening very fast. So the high specific heat of water versus air can become a very significant factor when it comes to life and death situations of a sinking ship, so to speak. AC2GS, K2LIW.
I would think that that has more to do with thermal conductivity than specific heat.
I'm going to agree with that, but both of those factors. Water has high thermal conductivity and high specific heat. To change the temperature of water takes a lot of energy. To change the temperature of air takes nowhere near as much energy. So my skin temperature might be 90 degrees Fahrenheit, and the air in direct contact with my skin can easily be raised to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. The water in direct contact with my skin cannot easily be raised to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm going to lose heat real fast, and I'm going to be in a lot of trouble if I'm in 50-degree water for more than, let's say, 10 minutes.
I would agree with you, Dick. That's a factor as well. I mean, that's the problem with physics. The more you take it into the real world, the more there are these novel, interesting complications. I just wanted people to kind of think in terms of, you know, the next time they want to really show off at a cocktail party like anyone would really care, is when the subject of temperature comes up, rather than just saying it's the average kinetic energy, it's the average translational kinetic energy, which most people will just look at and walk away from them, kind of, you know, be polite and such. But otherwise, I just thought it would be kind of an interesting thing to kind of nuance the discussion that we've had before about temperature. So temperature is kinetic energy, but it's primarily translational, which Dick mentioned about an hour or two ago when he was talking about something else.
EDH with a question.
And I'm going to add something about ideal gas law. EDH, go ahead.
If you have more degrees of freedom at the molecular level, doesn't that increase the heat capacity, the specific heat of the substance? In other words, if you have, in addition to translation, you say you have a rotational mode or a vibrational mode, with each one of those additional degrees of freedom, of energy storage, I guess, doesn't that increase the heat capacity? Go ahead.
Comment.
Hey, Wes recognized, getting back to John, yes, that is why they use the ideal gas law, and they posit an ideal gas. The more freedoms of movement you have, the more non-translational types of kinetic energy a molecule can entertain, and that's where the extra energy sort of hides, and you don't have as much of a temperature increase for a given amount of either calories or joules or BTUs placed into the system.
I see. Thank you.
Yes, Wesley, you wanted to say something on the subject?
Yeah, he mentioned vibrational and rotational. It's a property of electromagnetic waves, transverse wave. So when we get the wavelength of ultraviolet, are we dealing with rotational or vibrational by deforming the particle impact of the radio wave? It's my few cents about that. And to explain.
Okay. In my mind, electromagnetism is an excitation of an electric and magnetic field in space-time. It is not the vibrations, other than the concept of frequencies. It is not rotation, except if you want to discern the polarization rotation. What I think you're alluding to is that when a photon of relatively low energy strikes an atom or a molecule, it is absorbed and translated into some form of kinetic energy. It could be translational velocity. It can be rotation. It can be vibration. All those phases can be induced by the absorption of relatively low energy photons. When you get up to the ultraviolet, the energy is sufficient not only to just cause it to move a little bit or to vibrate a little bit, but to knock the valence outermost electron completely out of its shell and ionize it. That's I think what you might be alluding to. But it's not that electromagnetism is rotation or vibration. It imparts its energy for matter to do different things, which includes rotation, translation, and vibration, as well as ionization.
It's complete. Controversial, would you say? An electromagnetic wave has a capacity to induce a vibration in charged particle. And more rapidly a particle vibrates, the harder it is. That's why we're talking about temperature as a translational value. So take HSI. We'll take the molecule, any molecule, that by the bond stretching, where the atom pulls apart and push together again, a bit like two particles connected by the spring. And this is the classical word of the high quantum numbers for the frequency vibration of the particle. It's a mechanical reaction to electromagnetic waves. Do you agree with that? And to Asia.
No, you're trying to put the classical physics veneer on quantum mechanics. It goes back to the days of Max Planck, that he really didn't want electron excitation to be quantized, so he decided to explain it as a bunch of wave resonators surrounding atoms. But no, I don't agree. I believe that ultimately all these things are energy. Electromagnetism are little packages of energy, and kinetic energy, both translational, vibrational, and rotational, are energy, and they're interconvertible from one to the other and back again. So a photon could be absorbed in a molecule, and the excess energy can be expressed as a translational velocity, or can be a vibration of two bonds, if it has two bonds, or it can have rotation around itself or around the bond. But I don't think photons are just vibrations, if you will.
I must agree with that, what you say. I use infortunate wording for it, but we're dealing with the change of temperature. And it's undeniable. We could talk about the particle scattering as a function of ultraviolet or visible spectroscopy that is found in Rayleigh scattering. We could generalize that Rayleigh light scattering equation is scattering intensity of the particle, but the actual outcome is changing of the temperature or the energy level. So that's why it's related to the subject. Yes, it is not mechanical, and to extra.
I was going to add a couple of words on ideal gas law. Right.
Please. Your TechNet is your TechNet.
Yeah, but this is your section. If you assume air at normal temperature and pressure is an ideal gas law, is the ideal gas law, it comes pretty close to doing a good job of predicting what happens when you're taking off your airplane on a high humidity day. Air is roughly 80% nitrogen, roughly 20 or 21% oxygen. The oxygen molecules are O2. Each oxygen molecule is 16 specific weight. O2 is going to be 32 gram molecular weight. Nitrogen is 14. N2 is 28. So the average molecular weight of a dry air molecule is approximately 29. Now let's add some humidity. Humidity is water molecules. Water is H2O. 1 O 16 plus 2 H's. Water molecule has got a gram molecular weight of relative 18. So the water molecules are 18. The air molecules are 28. As you add high humidity, the average density, pounds per cubic meter of air, goes down. That becomes extremely important when you're taking off your aircraft on a high humidity day. The air having lower density is going to give you less lift for the same wingspan and air velocity over that wing. So if you assume the ideal gas law, where some number of air molecules per cubic meter, Avogadro's number, so to speak, those gas molecules of relative 29 got replaced with water molecules of relative 18, and you use that simplistic approach to calculate the mass of a cubic meter of air, knowing the humidity, you come up very close to the reality of predicting how much lift you're going to get out of that airplane going down that runway on a high humidity day. We call high humidity heavy air. It's really light air. It makes sense because you get less evaporation off your body. It feels hot and heavy to you, uncomfortable, but it really is light air. So the ideal gas law in that case does a pretty good job of predicting how dangerous it is to take off your airplane on a high humidity day. Over to you, Roy. KQIIW.
I agree with you, Dick. The ideal gas law is an excellent one. I'm kind of really glad that everyone keeps calling it the ideal gas law, because it's very easy for people to start just calling it the gas law, and then you kind of lose a little bit of the nuance. But it's certainly very important, and, you know, I used it in school. I don't know if I used it that much except kind of in my head when I thought of temperature and pressure changes and such, but it's one of the biggies, and but it's sort of nice to know the little complicating fidgets around the edge of it. It may not impart that much of a difference in the same way that non-relativistic things kind of work reasonably well without having to bother with things like Lorentz transforms. But I don't know. I always like the little complications around the edges.
Now, on a slightly related subject, when I climb out of the ocean and my skin is wet and I walk across the beach, I feel cold. I climb out of my hot shower. Before I dry off, I climb out of the shower into the regular bathroom. I feel cold. So as water is evaporating off my body, in either of those cases, I feel cold. You ask the average person why. At the molecular level, what is happening? To me, that is an interesting piece of physics. I think we discussed that one once before. Over to you, Roy.
We talked about heat of vaporization. Matter of fact, One of the times I kind of tried to get people to think in terms of, everyone knows that when ice melts, it soaks up heat. And since things are symmetrical, when water freezes, it gives off heat, which people don't really like thinking about. So, yeah, heat of vaporization and different ways to consider it. You could just consider it as the kinetic energy, the higher kinetic energy of the liquid at the surface flies out free because it's the highest velocity and imparts some of its kinetic energy with it and decreases the average kinetic energy of your body.
When I freeze a gram of water, I have to remove roughly 80 calories per gram in order to freeze it, to go from 32 degrees Fahrenheit liquid to 32 degrees Fahrenheit ice. When I vaporize, when I boil off water, it's roughly 540 calories per gram. To boil away 1 gram of water takes 540 calories. So the heat of vaporization of water is 540 calories. That's one quantitative way of explaining why I feel cold. Water is evaporating. Each gram of water evaporating takes up 540 calories. Why does that happen? Why does water evaporating off my body require 540 calories of heat? Why does it make me feel cold? There's something deeper at the molecular level taking place. Rudy Roy, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, the point I thought was that water and your body is an average kinetic energy, but that's an average. There's a distribution. And the water that's going to do the phase change at the surface level is going to have a somewhat higher kinetic energy than the water that's sitting in around in the middle. And so it's the loss of the slightly higher kinetic energy water molecules going into gas. I mean, you could also do it in terms of kinetics of interactions versus liquid interactions, that the bonding energies of gases is much lower than the bonding energies of liquids, which isn't that much really different than the bonding energies of solid, which is why there is such a small heat of turning from solid to a liquid versus going from a liquid to a gas.
As I climb out of that shower, my skin temperature might be 90 degrees Fahrenheit. The water molecules on my skin have an average temperature of 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Some of those molecules of that water on my skin are at 80 degrees Fahrenheit. Some of them are at 100. The average of 90 degrees is just an average. Some of them are faster moving, some of them are slower moving. The ones that come up to the surface of the water that are moving faster, the 100 degree Fahrenheit ones, are more likely to bounce off and go into vapor, into the air. The hot molecules are leaving, the cold molecules stay. Therefore, I feel cold. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
I agree entirely, and most likely the thermal distribution can be defined using an equation with the Boltzmann constant. When Max Planck invented his equation, he invented both the Planck constant and the Boltzmann constant, which is a statistical constant value of the distribution of energy space. So I agree 100% with you.
You ask the average person at the molecular level, why do I feel cold when I get out of the shower? I think the majority of them don't know the answer to that. So do you, Roy?
Well, you know, I mean, I guess I'm cynical. If you ask the average person how a TV works, they tell you you plug it in and you turn it on. So I try not to ask people physics questions that I meet in the street for obvious reasons.
Question.
Yes, Kay.
Okay, I have two questions. You go swimming in the ocean. When you first enter the ocean, it feels cold, and then after you're bobbing around in there for a while, it feels warm, and the air here feels cold when you come out. And then I have a second question. I read that if you keep a freezer in your refrigerator packed, it's more efficient. And I don't understand why, even if you have like one item in the freezer, it once it freezes and everything stays the same temperature, right? Why would being packed make it more efficient? Thank you.
Okay, I want to do this quick because I don't want to screw up any more of Paul's time. He has his space report. As far as the water, my surmise would be that we are able to tell changes in temperature much more accurately than